Emily Everett's debut novel, All That Life Can Afford, has quickly become a cultural touchstone for millennials navigating the complexities of class, identity, and belonging. The book has garnered praise from literary icons like Zadie Smith, who called it a brilliantly observed portrait of a young woman trying to find her place in a world not designed for her. Since its publication, the novel has been featured in numerous book clubs, including Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine, and has sparked important conversations about privilege and authenticity in our social media age. Drawing on her own experiences as an American studying in London, Everett crafts a compelling coming-of-age story that resonates with anyone who has ever felt like an outsider looking in. When we first meet Anna, she's desperately trying to avoid paying for a train ticket to Brighton, crafting an elaborate lie about being a teacher headed to an elite girls' school. This small deception foreshadows the larger web of pretense she'll soon weave. Anna is an American graduate student at Queen Mary University, studying English literature while juggling multiple jobs to stay afloat in expensive London. Having lost her mother to diabetes complications just before moving abroad, Anna carries both grief and financial anxiety everywhere she goes. London represents both escape and opportunity for Anna. Since childhood, she's been enchanted by England through books, first through myths of King Arthur and Peter Pan, then later through Jane Austen's novels. Her scholarship to Smith College had included study abroad, giving her a taste of the life she now pursues more permanently. But the reality of being a working-class American in class-conscious Britain proves challenging. At university, her British classmates possess cultural knowledge she lacks, making her feel perpetually behind. Meanwhile, her tutoring job for a prestigious agency gives her glimpses into the lives of London's elite, whose gleaming homes and carefree lifestyles stand in stark contrast to her precarious existence. Anna's life changes dramatically when she's assigned to tutor Philippa "Pippa" Wilder, a teenager staying at the luxurious Savoy Hotel. Over their sessions, they develop a rapport, and Pippa's mother unexpectedly invites Anna to spend Christmas and New Year's on the French Riviera, continuing the tutoring while enjoying an all-expenses-paid holiday. Despite concerns about violating her contract with the tutoring agency, Anna accepts, seeing it as a chance to experience the kind of life her diabetes-stricken mother never got to live, one free from constant financial worry. The Wilders' villa in Saint-Tropez is a revelation to Anna, a sprawling cream-colored stone house with a terracotta roof built into the hillside overlooking the Mediterranean. Though not the Gatsby-esque mansion she'd imagined, it represents a level of luxury beyond her wildest dreams. A private chef preparing daily meals, a pool, hot tub, Boule's Court, and a terrace with breathtaking sea views. Anna's guest suite feels Grecian with white stone walls and includes an envelope with her full fee plus spending money. In this rarefied world, Anna meets Pippa's older sister, Faye, and her glamorous circle of friends, including the charismatic Callum and the handsome, flirtatious Theo. At Bar Soub, a dimly lit establishment overlooking the port, Anna experiences her first taste of truly elite social life. When confronted with her first oyster, a small but telling moment of class difference, Callum secretly slips her a tiny fork and demonstrates the technique, an unexpectedly intimate gesture that creates a connection between them. As Christmas approaches, Anna finds herself caught between worlds. She enjoys teaching Pippa while exploring Saint-Tropez's charming streets and historic sites. When Callum's borrowed vintage Citroen breaks down after a vineyard tour, Anna stays behind to help him while Faye abandons them. Drawing on knowledge from her working-class background, Anna diagnoses the coolant problem and helps get the car running again. During their walk to fetch water, they discuss their studies and career paths, developing a deeper connection despite their different backgrounds. The holiday culminates in a lavish New Year's Eve party where Anna, wearing a borrowed black sequined dress, catches the eye of Theo. As fireworks explode over the Mediterranean at midnight, Theo kisses Anna, beginning a relationship that will further entangle her in this seductive world of privilege. Returning to cold London in January, Anna resumes her hectic schedule of tutoring, teaching, and studying. Though she misses the warmth and luxury of Saint-Tropez, she's buoyed by memories of her nights with Theo and the prospect of seeing him again. Her fortunes improve further when Mrs. Wilder offers her the chance to house-sit their Highgate property while her sister is away, giving Anna a rent-free living situation in one of London's most exclusive neighborhoods. This unexpected opportunity marks the beginning of Anna's double life. Living in the Wilders' pristine Highgate house, she has access to Faye's extensive wardrobe of designer clothes and shoes. When Theo invites her for a walk and takes her to Highgate Cemetery, Anna borrows Faye's white tennis shoes without permission, the first of many such borrowings that will eventually lead to her downfall. As Anna becomes more deeply embedded in Theo's social circle, she meets his friends Tess, Ginny, and Zara, all products of Britain's elite education system and social hierarchy. When they recognize her Stella McCartney shoes, actually borrowed from Faye, Anna feels a familiar shame about class differences, but decides she might be able to fit into this world without revealing her true circumstances. Her friendship with Tess, who studied literature at UCL, opens doors to London's cultural treasures. During a visit to the British Library, Anna is moved to tears by Jane Austen's writing desk and original manuscript pages. Yet even as she forms genuine connections, the harsh reality of the publishing industry becomes clear. Internships are typically unpaid for 6 months with no guaranteed job after, and positions usually go to well-connected candidates from publishing families. This confirmation that Anna's career plan might be impossible knots her stomach, though Tess kindly offers to connect her with contacts at Bloomsbury. Encouraged by her friends Liv and Andre from her old life, Anna decides to establish herself as an independent tutor, using the prestigious Makepeace Avenue address as a credential. After facing rejection from a snobbish headmistress, Anna transforms herself with a professional haircut and borrowed designer clothes to create a more commanding presence. This strategy works brilliantly at St. Giles College, an expensive English language school for international students, where she secures an arrangement to offer well-paid SAT preparation classes. Anna's business flourishes, allowing her to adopt the lifestyle of her wealthy Highgate friends. She begins attending exclusive parties and events, including drinks at Soho House and a party where Mark Ronson is DJing. Yet maintaining this facade comes at a cost. She sees less of Liv and Andre, her authentic friends who know her true background. The contradictions in Anna's life come to a head during a chance encounter with Callum on Hampstead Heath. When his muddy dog jumps on Faye's expensive camel-colored pants that Anna is wearing, their interaction evolves into a tense conversation about Anna's deception. Callum reveals he's grown tired of the nightlife scene his friends still embrace, preferring simple gatherings like cooking dinner together. Their argument intensifies when Callum offers to replace the pants, implying he knows they're not hers and are beyond her budget. As Anna's two worlds collide, with Callum meeting Liv and Andre on Parliament Hill, she feels torn between the authentic connection she shares with her old friends and the glamorous but superficial life she's created with Theo's circle. Though she longs to join them for a simple evening of cooking pasta together, she needs to soak Faye's pants and prepare for her night out, aware that Callum is the only person who knows how much she has to lose. For her birthday, Anna's new friends surprise her with a trip to Lisbon, Portugal. They stay at the luxurious Pestana Palace, a 19th-century mansion with ornate decor and a Turkish spa. Despite initial nervousness about spending a full week with her new friends, Anna finds herself enjoying Lisbon's sights under Palum's guidance. Their relationship has warmed, with both letting their guards down. On her birthday, which coincides with Portugal's Freedom Day, Anna experiences a perfect day, wandering through street celebrations, culminating in a magical moment when helicopters shower red carnations over the crowd. For dinner, the group has arranged another surprise. Theo has flown in just for her birthday meal at a 2-Michelin-star restaurant. Despite the extravagance, Anna feels increasingly uncomfortable with the pretentious 11-course tasting menu. Only Callum seems to notice and share her discomfort with the ritual of wealth. As the meal progresses, Anna realizes that while she's achieved the transformation she thought she wanted, it feels hollow, just gold leaf on a runny egg. She reflects that her parents never wanted her to have fancy things, only to live without the constant worry about money that had drained her mother's life. On their last day in Lisbon, Ana becomes lost in increasingly dark, rainy streets without directions to their meeting point for dinner. Just as panic overwhelms her, Callum appears, having been searching for her. He hugs her until her tears stop, his voice full of genuine concern. Later that evening, Ana enjoys a delicious home-cooked seafood meal with Callum and his Portuguese relatives. She learns that, contrary to her assumptions about his wealthy background, Callum's grandparents owned a restaurant in London before retiring. In this comfortable, unpretentious setting, Ana finally confides about her mother's death and her struggles with grief. She admits to creating a different persona in London to escape her past. Callum encourages her to be honest with their friends, promising support. Unexpectedly, Callum kisses Ana, creating further complications in her already complex emotional life. The inevitable exposure of Anna's deception unfolds at what was meant to be the social event of the season, the party to end all parties, at Tess and Ginny's father's palatial mansion on Billionaire's Row. The evening begins with promise, as Ana, wearing a borrowed cobalt blue Elisab couture gown from Faye's closet, arrives on Theo's arm. The dress transforms her, its delicate beading and flowing silk, making her feel like someone who has never known the sting of rejection or the weight of financial struggle. For a few precious moments, she truly believes she belongs in this world of old money and careful breeding. The carefully constructed illusion shatters when Faye makes an unexpected entrance, her eyes immediately drawn to the distinctive dress that Ana is wearing, a dress Faye had custom ordered for a specific event the previous season. The recognition extends beyond the gown to the Jimmy Choo shoes that complete the ensemble, both items Faye knows intimately from her own wardrobe. The confrontation that follows is brutal in its public nature. Faye, her voice carrying across the marble-floored ballroom, denounces Ana as a fraud and con artist, ensuring maximum humiliation before the cream of London society. When Callum attempts to intervene, suggesting that Faye's anger stems from losing her pet project and charity case, his words only fuel Faye's fury. She launches into a calculated character assassination, painting Ana as a calculating social climber who's been manipulating both Callum and Theo for financial gain. Through mascara-stained tears, Ana attempts to defend herself, insisting she never meant to steal anything, not the dress, not the lifestyle, not the men. But in the rarefied air of old money London, intent matters far less than appearance, and Anna's has been irreparably damaged. The following morning brings swift and decisive consequences. The Wilders' family solicitor, a stern-faced man in an impeccable suit, arrives at the Highgate house with non-negotiable terms. Ana must vacate the property immediately, taking only items she can prove she owned before moving in. Most painfully, she must cease all contact with the family, including her cherished relationship with Pippa. When Ana protests that Pippa is the one who initiates their conversations, the lawyer's mention of possible legal action serves as a chilling reminder of the power imbalance at play. Finding sanctuary in Liv's cluttered but welcoming flat, Ana begins the humbling process of rebuilding her life. She pawns the iPhone Theo had given her, a device that once symbolized her acceptance into their world, for barely enough cash to buy groceries. In Liv's tiny kitchen, she prepares American pancakes, a peace offering that comes with a full confession. Over maple syrup and coffee, Ana explains how she'd been seduced by the allure of becoming untouchable, like the wealthy people she'd watched on reality shows, believing she could transform herself through sheer force of will. Though full forgiveness remains distant, Ana discovers an unexpected liberation in finally being authentic. In Liv's modest flat, speaking without filtering her words or concealing her background, she finds a different kind of freedom than the one I'd had in Highgate, one built on truth rather than carefully constructed lies. Anna's carefully reconstructed life crumbles piece by piece in the aftermath of Faye's vindictive social media campaign. Her tutoring clients, wealthy families intensely protective of their children's education, withdraw their business one after another, each cancellation arriving with thinly veiled references to trust issues and background concerns. For 6 weeks, she exists in a state of suspended animation on Liv's couch, transforming herself into a ghost in her friend's apartment. She leaves before dawn and returns well after midnight, careful to minimize her presence in the only safe space she has left. Between grueling shifts at the bar and her few remaining teaching positions, Anna seeks refuge in the British Library's vast reading rooms. The scholarly atmosphere, with its whispered conversations and gentle rustle of turning pages, provides a cocoon of normalcy. Here, surrounded by fellow researchers and ancient texts, she can almost pretend her life hasn't imploded. She throws herself into her dissertation work, finding that academic analysis offers a welcome escape from her personal chaos. Her precarious stability shatters completely when the university's administration office contacts her with an ultimatum: pay the outstanding tuition balance in full immediately, or face dismissal from the program. Her last financial lifeline, the substantial sum owed by Muscle Hill Academy for months of teaching, seems tantalizingly within reach until she arrives at the school only to find herself blocked at the entrance. Security escorts her off the premises as if she were a common criminal. The final blow comes minutes later via email. The tutoring agency terminates her contract, citing breach of non-compete clauses, and announces they're withholding her final paycheck as compensation for alleged damages. In desperation, Anna arranges to meet Callum at a quiet cafe near King's Cross Station. As he reviews for meticulously kept records of unpaid wages, his legal training kicks in, and he makes a crucial discovery. Muscle Hill Academy's registration as a charitable institution makes them particularly vulnerable to public scrutiny and regulatory oversight. Though still completing his legal qualifications, Callum offers a pragmatic solution. He'll draft a carefully worded letter that his uncle, a senior partner at a prestigious London law firm, might be persuaded to put on official letterhead. Their professional discussion gradually shifts to personal territory as Anna finally offers the apology she's been carrying. Callum's response surprises her with its empathy. He admits to keeping her secret partly because he was rooting for her to find freedom from her past, though he gently acknowledges that this was the wrong way to do it. When he inquires about her plans moving forward, Anna recites the words that have become her daily meditation. "I'm going to get my degree and then get the 2-year work visa. Another 2 years to do it right this time, as myself." In these words lies not just a plan, but a promise to herself, a commitment to rebuild her life on a foundation of truth. Anna's academic journey undergoes a profound transformation as she expands beyond her initial focus on Jane Austen to explore deeper spiritual and emotional connections in the works of E.M. Forster, Edith Wharton, and Henry James. Their novels, with their complex narratives of displacement and belonging, begin to mirror her own experiences in ways she hadn't anticipated. During a pivotal visit to Jane Austen's cottage in Chawton, Anna finds herself deeply moved by the parallels between her circumstances and Austen's own period of displacement. The modest cottage, where Austen wrote her most celebrated works while facing financial uncertainty, becomes a powerful symbol of resilience and creativity under constraint. This visit catalyzes a breakthrough in Anna's academic perspective. She begins to see how these canonical authors approached the theme of displacement with remarkable nuance, from Forster's exploration of cross-cultural connections in A Passage to India to Wharton's acute observations of social outsiders in The House of Mirth. Through her research, Anna discovers that these novels offer no simple formula for navigating unfamiliar territories. Some characters, like Isabel Archer in James's Portrait of a Lady, face bitter disappointments for their presumption, while others, like Lucy Honeychurch in Forster's A Room with a View, find unexpected joy in breaking free from social constraints. After completing her dissertation, Anna's professional life takes an unexpected turn. Though initially disappointed when rejected for an apprenticeship at the British Library, she's offered an even more compelling position, developing educational resources from the archives. This role, which comes with better compensation and visa security, allows her to make the library's treasures accessible to students from diverse backgrounds across the globe, work that feels both meaningful and aligned with her own experience as an outsider seeking connection through literature. Simultaneously, her determined pursuit of unpaid teaching fees finally bears fruit, providing the funds needed to clear her remaining tuition debt. A chance meeting with Theo becomes a turning point in Anna's personal life. She learns that Callum has been quietly working behind the scenes for months, using his legal expertise to prevent the Wilders from pressing charges against her. His dedication, including a trip to Saint-Tropez to present legal arguments, reveals the depth of his commitment. When Theo attempts to rekindle their relationship with promises of financial security and a new apartment, Anna finds herself unmoved, her heart already certain about her feelings for Callum. The story reaches its emotional crescendo outside the British Library, where Anna and Callum finally confront their feelings for each other. When Anna suggests joining friends for drinks, Callum reveals his more intimate plan to cook dinner for her. His gift of marshmallow fluff, remembering her casual mention of it as a childhood luxury during her free lunch days, demonstrates a level of attentiveness and understanding that deeply moves her. This simple gesture, combining thoughtfulness with memory, becomes symbolic of their connection. For Anna, who has navigated so much uncertainty, this moment represents not just finding love, but finding home, the best right thing she's been searching for all along. In the final chapter, Anna has moved into a modest 3-bedroom flat in the Haringey Ladder with Liv and Andre. She places her mother's ashes on the bookshelf alongside her dog-eared Jane Austen novels and collection of tourist brochures, planning to keep adding to this collection. She resolves to call her father to let him know she's settled with housing and employment, hoping to repair that relationship as well. Callum visits their new place, bringing ingredients to make peri-peri chicken using his friend's recipe. The four friends walk to Alexandra Palace Park to watch the sunset over London. As they share drinks and banter on a bench overlooking the city, Anna reflects on her 18 months in London. Andre jokes that her dramatic experiences were like reality TV with twists and turns and double crosses, but Anna admits she'd be happy if her life made for boring TV for a while. Looking at the sunset with Callum beside her and her friends nearby, Anna no longer feels the need to constantly record exciting London experiences in her journal. She's found contentment without needing to prove her life is good enough, exciting enough, glamorous enough. The friends make plans for a Christmas trip to Vienna, where they'll visit markets, drink glühwein, and hear choirs sing in cathedrals. Anna realizes she's learned to travel light through her year of experiences, needing nothing but the company of those she loves. Through her journey of deception, exposure, and redemption, Anna discovers that true belonging comes not from fitting into someone else's world, but from creating a space where you can be authentically yourself. In the end, the modest flat in Haringey, with friends who know and accept her, feels more like home than any mansion in Highgate or villa in Saint-Tropez ever could.